Hi. In our musical segment with which we usually start the show, it's called The Popular Wobbly. And it's got a cute, catchy tune. So sing along if you're out there.
I'm as mild-mannered as I can be, and I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me, and he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the jailer, he went wild over me, and he locked me up and threw away the key. It seems to be the rage, so they keep me in a cage. They go wild, simply wild over me. Will the roses grow wild over me when I'm gone into the land that is to be? When my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Well, thank God he went wild over me when I knelt beside the throne on bended knee. When the angels heard me yell, they shot me down to hell. They went wild, simply wild over me.
All right. And now fellow worker Lynn is going to go ahead and kick off introductions to everybody here.
Hi. We are the Wobblies, Wobbly Radio, which is Industrial Workers of the World. And we do a radio show once a month, and we hope you enjoy it. So for you repeat listeners, great. And for you new people, hope you like it too. So we're going to start off with our introduction so that you know who we are, kind of, what we do with the IWW.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
My name is Marilyn. I go by she, they, and I am a retired mental health worker. I've been a member of the Wobblies since about 2008. And I am a delegate listener, so if you're listening and you like what you hear of the IWW, you can contact either me or Noah, and you can join the one big union.
And my name is fellow worker Noah. I'm the branch secretary of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the IWW. I've been in the IWW since March of 2021, and in March of this year, I got elected branch secretary. Like fellow worker Marilyn, I am also a delegate, so if you're interested in getting signed up with the One Big Union, you can always reach out to the IWW through IWW.org, or you can reach out to Tacoma@IWW.org if you want to shoot us an email. And my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Gordon. I've been a Wobbly since 2008. That's a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. I live in Bremerton. I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch. I have been a delegate in the past. I've also been on the Literature Committee, and now I'm on the WOB Radio Committee. And my pronouns are he, him, and fellow worker.
Hey, guys. Hello, gals. And howdy to all my non-binary friends and pals. My name is Alan. I joined the IWW sometime in the 70s. It's been so long I've forgotten when. I'm a retired nurse. So I was a two-card holder, been a Wobbly, and I also spent the last 18 years as a nurse at the Western State Hospital as a member of ASPE, or the Washington Federation of State Employees. That's enough for me for now.
Ready?
Yes.
My name is Eric. I joined IWW in August of this year, and my pronouns are he and him.
I'm Lynn, and I am a retired social worker and medical interpreter. I joined in 2018. And I go by she, her.
So I will go ahead and kick us off with one last part for our introduction here. I will go ahead and read you a section of the preamble to the Industrial Workers of the World Constitution. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed in the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. Let's go ahead and jump into labor news. This is our first segment of reporting for you today. We have quite the lineup of stories for you because there's been so many developments within the past month. The Boeing machinists are on strike, as many of you are aware. Me and fellow worker Eric actually attended one of the picket lines out in Auburn and met with several of the workers out there. Currently, the IAM, the International Association of Machinists, Local 751, is the union that's on strike. And this strike is covering multiple different airplane manufacturing facilities owned by Boeing. When I attended the picket line, I was really surprised to see the number of not just union folks on the picket line, but also a bunch of other organizations and community support as well. People were driving by, honking in support, giving a wave. Obviously, me and Eric were there as members of the IWW, but we also, well, I also ran into Teamsters members, UAW members, SEIU union members.
Solidarity.
Absolutely. It's probably one of the first pickets I've attended where that amount of cross-union collaboration has really happened. Recent developments regarding the Boeing strike, the 33,000 workers are still walking the picket lines. However, a few days ago, Boeing cut the health care of everybody who's currently on strike while contract negotiations are still ongoing.
Yeah, wow. It cut off at the end of September.
Yeah, it cut off at the end of September. Thank you.
What poor management on their part.
Well, yeah. I imagine that part of their agreement was that if they went on strike, then that technically means that their classification of employment is probably shifted and it allows the company to do that. I'm not going to make a guaranteed statement on that, but it does put the strikers in a pretty dire situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's an unfair labor practice myself. They're interfering with the duties of the union.
Mm.
I think it's illegal even under Taft-Hartley, but I can't be sure about that.
Undermining the well-being of their workers.
Absolutely.
Like, in really direct, specific ways. Mm-hmm. Their families.
Well, yeah, little kids.
Well, I'll object. I don't think so. Because when the National Education Association, when their employees, it's a union that has employees, when the employees went on strike after months of being ignored, the first thing that the NEA bosses did was they cut off their employees' healthcare benefits, including people with necessary needs like
disabled folks, yeah,
and your breathing apparatus, whatever you need to stay alive. And Kaiser Family, the Kaiser Foundation published this in their weekly newsletter, and all of a sudden people were aghast and shocked that the union would do that to its employees, and they reversed themselves immediately.
Yeah.
It's not because it was illegal, because it was a bad look.
And same thing with the Boeing machinists that are on strike. There has been a lot of public outcry against Boeing. Boeing is under a lot of flack for not negotiating in good faith with the union. Not only that, but also previous airplane-related mishaps that have occurred with one of their new models. And they, so far, during this strike, Boeing has lost capital B, $1 billion in net profit because they've essentially held out on bargaining for so long at this point.
I heard it was something like that a day. what the
cost. Or a month.
It was a huge number for a small amount of time.
Right. And they've only been on strike for a month. So a billion across, 30 days? That's probably several million dollars a day.
Yeah, every day. So my understanding is that if the current, the old contract is going to be in effect till January of 25, and then they'll actually negotiate, try to settle it. So it's not, not done yet.
No.
I don't think, so they haven't voted yet.
The offers that Boeing has been putting forward, just to give some context for the listener as well, a lot of the gains that the union members want to make are especially in regards to their previous pay structure is based off of essentially COLA estimates, cost of living expenses, from 2008, 2011, right during the recession. So they're looking for a 40% increase over the next few years, whereas Boeing has only been offering 25 to 30. There's also a big part of the conversation as well on the union members about pensions.
Oh, yeah.
Boeing is looking to cut pensions. They have, yeah.
They don't.
Right. So the union workers really want those pensions back.
Yeah, well, I mean, to take something away like that, that's more cruel than never having had them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I couldn't. You talk about people going postal. Imagine working for years and years, and you're looking forward to that. It's coming, and then it's not coming to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the strike continues to go on. Apparently, Boeing and the IAM 751 are back in contract negotiations. So there is some rumor that hopefully the strike will come to an end soon, but it has been a month. So I can't really make a definite claim. And that's kind of the thing with strikes in general. Sometimes they're 24 hours. Sometimes they go on for several months, like with the United Mine Workers down in, I think it was Georgia or Alabama.
Alabama,
yeah. So going to keep our eyes on the horizon, and hopefully the Boeing workers will get what they're fighting for.
I'd just like to point out to the listeners that the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, is an industrial union, meaning not necessarily smokestacks, but we organize by the industry so that we don't have 10 different unions that are competing with one another for wages and benefits. Our idea is to organize the entire industry. For instance, if you're an airline, you got pilots, you got baggage handlers, you got mechanics, you got flight attendants, and they all bargain separately. Under the IWW's idea, we would bargain as one union. That's what we mean when you hear some of our members say one big union. So just to allow the listening audience to know that even though we're in solidarity with the labor movement in general, we have different ideas as to how to organize. But we stand in solidarity with our union, fellow workers and brothers and sisters, pretty much all the time. We'll walk their pickets and we'll support their cause.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon. Well said. Hold on a second. Oh, that's going to be fun to edit out.
I was going to say, yeah.
Sorry, my nose is just running. Another interesting bit of labor-related news that we'd like to share with you. As we reported on in the previous episode, the Teamsters president is not a very popular person, either within his union or without. The Teamsters, like many major trade unions, is made up of a large population of members, 1.3 million, to give you an exact number. And so people's political affiliations internally definitely vary. The Teamsters president has been very cuddly with Donald Trump and spoke at the Republican National Convention and has been kind of going through this business union, in quotation marks, business unionism strategy of kind of playing to all the sides in the hopes of whoever wins the presidency, the union will somehow come out on top. But as we all know, the Republican Party is not terribly pro-union as an organization.
Did he not go down to Mar-a-Lago too?
Yes, he also had lunch with Trump in Mar-a-Lago for a few hours.
That's Sean O'Brien, am I correct?
No, that's the auto workers.
No, that's Sean Fain is auto workers.
Sean Fain is auto workers. Sean O'Brien is president of the Teamsters. Thank you. There's two Seans. And I like one Sean more than the other, quite frankly.
It was the one just on TV a couple days ago, and he had a shirt on saying, I forget what it said. But anyway, he was just really an angry guy. Said we own the docks, I think.
That was ILA.
That was ILA, yeah. The Teamsters did an internal poll of all of their membership, and it was like 60-40. It was either 50-50 or 60-40 in favor of Donald Trump. So there is definitely a conservative base to a lot of the Teamsters members who are in the union. And because President Sean O'Brien has been getting a lot of flack for his associations with Trump, he decided on an executive level that the Teamsters union as a whole from the executive part is not going to be endorsing a candidate for president. And this is where things get interesting, because all of the locals and multi-state districts of the Teamsters, they're kind of broken up into different sections of the country, all basically said, actually, no, every single Teamsters district has endorsed Kamala Harris at this point, I think with only a few holdout exceptions. So it's kind of interesting to see how on a district level, and even on to a certain degree on a membership level, a lot of the people are pushing back against the Teamsters president in regards to his stance on the current presidential election. And I think it's definitely interesting because we will be talking about the IWW and its stances on political affiliation later. We will be talking more about the IWW and its stances on political affiliation later in the show. But it is very interesting to see how the internal dynamics of a large trade union like the Teamsters has worked out so far. So that's just my two cents.
Another item in labor news that we would like to touch on is the recent strike action by the International Longshoremen's Association. That's the ILA. And they control the ports and the docks on the East Coast and on the Gulf Coast. On our coast, on the West Coast, it's the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union. And they are pretty much in solidarity with the ILA. And what happened is that the ILA threatened, they actually did. They went out for a couple of days, shutting down all these ports. I mean, from Houston to New York to Boston to Philadelphia. And it really put the squeeze and demonstrates that the power of the working class is manifest through refusing to give our work when, you know, conditions warrant that. So the interesting part of that is that the International Transport Workers Federation, ITF, and the Maritime Union of Australia, the MUA, they are standing in solidarity with the ILA. And this is serious business, because if the ILA goes on strike and the longshore, they call them dockers in the Anglophone world, in Australia and New Zealand and other places that speak English. When the dockers go on strike, and they go on strike internationally, this really fouls up the profit margin for the International Association of the Shipping Companies. It's called USMX. That's the one in America. Which means United States Maritime Shippers. I don't know where they got the X. But the thing is that the owners of these companies, these big companies, you see them all the time. You see Maersk, you see Costco, you see all these, you know, containers. They're the people that set wages and benefits really kind of internationally. They're not supposed to be doing that. But they're an international corporation. So when the ILA went on strike, hit them hard, they realized they were losing gazillions a day, and so they came to the table very rapidly with the ILA, and they came to a tentative agreement, what in union talk is called a TA. But all that means is that the rank and file will be the final arbiter of if they accept that contract or not. And I believe it was pretty generous, the initial offer, that is, it was 60% rise in wages over 6 years or something like that. Don't quote me, but it was a, you know, fairly good victory. And to me, these owners associations like the United States Maritime Alliance and other owners of in other industries have been having a free hand in setting wages and conditions for a long time, especially under the previous occupant of the White House, but even under the so-called, you know, liberal administration of the current president and his vice president. They, in the end, they work together. They're both capitalist parties, just one's more extreme than the other. But I bring this up because the ILA has got 85,000 members, and they're the people that load and unload all the big cargo and container ships in ports worldwide. And if they go out on strike, that means the profit machine shuts down. So I mention this because to prove that workers standing in solidarity with one another and in solidarity with workers and other unions can really affect social change.
Yeah, no, and again, I was mentioning this before we started recording. I think that there's a very interesting parallel to what's going on with the Boeing workers and the ILA strike that just recently reached a tentative agreement, like you said. The Boeing workers have been out on a picket line for a month, and contract negotiations between Boeing and the International Association of Machinists 751 have been teeth-grindingly slow.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the ILA, they had a really strong turnout right from the get-go. It was a massive strike that took up the whole East Coast. We had international unions backing them as well. I believe a lot of their bargaining team, as well as even some of their executive members, seem to come off as very kind of hard-hitting individuals. They're like, come back to the table now or we're going to make it a problem kind of attitude that really tends to bring employers to the table. So yeah, no, I'm really happy with what happened. I mean, they were only on strike for 2 or 3 days, and like that, they're in a tentative agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I can only wish that the same would happen for the Boeing workers soon, and hopefully, you know, Boeing will get the picture that they need to start bargaining in good faith with their workers.
Well, this harkens back to what we talk about frequently on the radio show, which is that the Machinists Union bargained. I was a member of the Machinists Union for 30 years, albeit in a local that couldn't go on strike. I was working for the Navy in the Navy Yard in Bremerton. And so we were proscribed from going on strike and participating in politics through the Hatch Act. But what I'm getting at is that we could still, you know, we had a bargaining voice for working conditions and for, you know, possible raises. You know, we would influence the federal government because we were the sole bargaining voice. But it was the Metal Trades Council, which meant all the industrial trades on the waterfront had a single voice to bargain with the government. And if more unions would follow that industrial model, we would have the labor situation cleaned up in a jiffy. So I'm just mentioning this to emphasize that solidarity is the key to getting workers' liberation and liberation of the working class and the dismantlement of capitalism.
Absolutely. I think if there's only one more story I wanted to mention really briefly in terms of labor news. President Biden said something very interesting in an interview when the longshore workers initially went out on strike. And it was literally just a one-sentence quip, but he said something along the lines of, I'm not going to interfere with the dock workers' strike. I don't believe in calling in Taft-Hartley on them to force them into a tentative agreement or to force them back to work. Which, even for somebody who is so politically centrist as Biden, especially on labor issues, I mean, I'll give the man credit where credit is due, but the fact that he even mentioned Taft-Hartley and even just made a statement about it was kind of like, oh, wow, this person might have learned his lesson from the rail strike that he and Congress helped bust.
Mm-hmm.
That never happened. So I just thought that was a very interesting last-minute kind of thing that happened.
I think it's a matter of his confusion. There was a reference to military strikes in Yemen,
mm-hmm.
and Biden popped up, I'm in favor of labor, and we'll settle this strike. Yeah, right?
I saw that too,
What was he thinking about? Not thinking, it's a case to be.
Yeah, I mean, he probably just didn't hear the
He was confused.
Yeah.
He was. And this thing about the railroad workers. Okay, with the United Auto Workers were under negotiations. And he put on the cap and walked down the picket line. He got the TV up, right? Mm-hmm. And then he went away. But the most supportive president of labor ever, they said. Well, a week later, when the railroad workers went on strike, or threatened to, he threatened to imprison them.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the same guy, is it? I guess so.
I mean, yeah, he definitely screwed up with the rail workers, and it at the very least, he has been trying to, behind the scenes, push rail companies to give their workers actual sick days and stuff like that. But the fact of the matter is, those workers could have gotten those sick days a hell of a lot faster if they just went on strike.
And they were threatened with jail time. Mm-hmm. And that's why they didn't. And they should have, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell people to go to jail if they don't want to. But,
we can all wildcat strike in our dreams, but the second that there's handcuffs on your wrists, yeah, reality kind of comes back into focus.
And the trains won't move.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
Exactly. And but, just like with the longshore workers.
Yep.
Yeah. Do we want to take another break before we jump into the roundtable? All right, fellow workers, moving on in our radio show today. As always, we like to have a roundtable discussion about something that is related to the world of labor, labor organizing, labor law. And today we will be talking a little bit about labor and politics. Specifically, I think that a lot of people find an aspect of the IWW interesting, which is that we do not endorse political candidates or parties. Now, it is an election year, and I'm sure we've all been following that with just glee and abandon and saccharin in our hearts and our minds and our souls. But I think that the IWW's position on politics is very interesting because it's very closely interlinked with its philosophy of labor should influence society rather than waiting for politics to eventually influence how labor operates. I'll go ahead and open it up to the rest of the fellow workers here.
I want to kick this off. This is Marilyn speaking, and this is a very interesting subject. I'm a member of DSA, mm-hmm. Democratic Socialists. They definitely do. They are very labor-oriented, but they also work very hard to get socialist candidates elected. And then I've seen the flip side of that. People that are very passionate about labor and labor rights, but may have different political attitudes, maybe ones that I don't agree with or you don't agree with, but they're in solidarity with the issue of labor. Mm-hmm. And when parties or when groups espouse a certain political party, they can alienate people that otherwise might very much want to be working with you on labor issues. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I see that the fact that we're sitting around this table and alive and not in prison is actually a political statement.
Absolutely.
And so I understand people who feel like everything is political. So,
fellow worker Gordon?
Yeah, I think everything is political and separated from what is known as politics here in the United States and Canada. As electoral politics exclusively. And, I take a more, let's say, dialectical materialist view of what politics is, which is social practice. So, in other words, politics is the interaction between people in the checkout line on an elevator anywhere. That's politics.
But
that's,
it's not necessarily electoral politics.
Correct. And when we're dealing with people who have a certain view of, you say the word politics and automatically people in America think elections. Mm-hmm. You know, and they said, I'm not into politics, but who was it that said, you might not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you.
That's mm-hmm. right.
And so the thing is, you know, I vote still. I take Chomsky's view of it. I take just about enough time to, you know, fill out the ballot. That's the amount of time I spend on elections because it does make a difference the lower down the list you go. As Marilyn, you know very well from local politics, Tacoma can be pretty corrupt, could be pretty inside deal-y, you know, the whole warehouse thing that you talk about.
Right, right.
You know, that who got that through? You know, that's all right. Inside politics.
The deals are all made behind closed doors right. Before they ever come to city council.
Right. Yeah, at city council.
Let me interrupt here. You said at the lower levels. No, it's not at the lower levels. It starts at the lower levels and the backdoor deals go on to the very top.
Yes.
Let's not pretend it gets pure and clear the higher we get up on the mountain.
Oh, no. Worse. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to imply that.
I look at the example of myself and my oldest son. He defines himself as an anarchist. Mm-hmm. He's a gun-toting anarchist who lives in Ecuador, but he's working in the United States. And he and I have very, very different political views. It's not that he's a Trumpist, but he rejects all of the politics, the electoral politics. He says, the world is going to hell. There's nothing you can do about it. I'm going to take care of my biological family in the mountains of Ecuador. That's different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he might be willing to join a labor movement if he stays in the United States, because he certainly is interested in labor issues. But as far as the rest of it, he'd laugh. He'd say we were gullible and naive.
Just to interject something, the word anarchist, too, can be fraught, because there are a lot of ANCAPs.
What's that?
That's an anarchist capitalist, which is a contradiction in terms. It's an oxymoron, right?
That would be the Elon Musk.
That would be the basically Elon Musk types. Yeah, the libertarians. Libertarian used to be the word in Europe for anarchist, and
right,
they've just co-opted so many of the tropes of leftism, right?
Thanks, Milton Friedman.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And
Ayn Rand.
Exactly.
But I think when I think about politics, specifically with the within the context of unions, and how the trade unions will view politics versus how the IWW views politics, I went to a Central Labor Council meeting here in Tacoma a couple of years ago. It was a midterm election of some kind or a special.
Did they go
election.
Outdoor belling and get out the vote and all of that?
Well, I'll get to that in just a second. But I was at the Central Labor Council meeting here in Tacoma for Pierce County, and there was a candidate running for county council. I can't remember her name. She seemed like a very smart, very educated, very motivated woman. And she kind of gave her, you know, her elevator speech to all mm-hmm. the union representatives that were there. And she was looking for the Central Labor Council's endorsement. Mm-hmm. And people were asking her questions about, like, you know, tell me a little bit about your life. Tell me what, you know, unions mean to you, et cetera, et cetera. I was just there as a guest with a friend of mine for one of the state employees unions. The entire time I'm watching this candidate give her elevator speech and listening to people ask very softball questions, there's one question that I wish I had stood up and asked, even though I was a guest there. And the question would have been this: what are you actually going to do for unions once you're in office? And a follow-up to that, would a county council position even be able to do anything for unions? What are the, you know, roles and responsibilities of that particular position? What is going to be your impact on labor organizing in the county if you get elected? And nobody asked that question. It also reminds me of another quote. It's not the notes that get played, it's the notes that are chosen not to be played.
Miles Davis.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think that the trade unions, I understand their perspective on politics.
Did they endorse her?
Yes, they ultimately endorsed her by an almost unanimous vote. I mean, I can't remember if county council members run with political parties, but she definitely seemed more on the Democratic side of things. I get where the trade unions are coming from with being involved in politics. And as I was talking about with the Teamsters earlier, a lot of these major trade unions, their membership, like with, for example, with the Teamsters, 1.3 million people, that's 1.3 million people's worth of different political opinions. And so they have to cater to their membership depending on how they feel about politics, which is why the executive board of the Teamsters decided not to endorse anybody, because a lot of the union membership was unfortunately in favor of Trump. And apparently so is Sean O'Brien. But then all the local districts turned around and said, actually, no, we're going to endorse Kamala Harris because, at least on paper, she does put herself forward as a pro-labor candidate. You had something? Kamala, my apologies. Bad pronunciation on my part.
I'm thinking of a time that the Central Labor Council had the opportunity to endorse a woman that I had a lot of respect for, Sarah Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And chose not to because that certain members accused her of being anti-labor because she would not accept that police were regular union members. Instead, she felt that they were carrying out the policies of the authorities and that they basically were a guild.
Mm-hmm.
And because she did not approve of the police force being members of the union, they accused her of being anti-union and wouldn't endorse her.
Mm. I imagine the police union had a lot of money to throw around to spread that message, I'm sure.
Well, it's similar to conflating being anti-Semitic and being anti-Zionist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, it's a very, you know, similar analogy there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Similar analogy.
Anyway. I do work from Jobs with Justice.
Yeah.
Definitely pro-labor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of brings us back around to our union's policy. And to clarify for the listeners, the Central Labor Council is a function of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah.
Or as fellow worker Alan likes to call it, AFL-CIA.
And let's not forget that.
Let's not forget it, fellow worker. But I just want to say that the Central Labor Council is an AFL-CIO organization on a state and, you know, a regional level. So Kitsap County has one, King County has one. And then what is it, Thurston,
Mason Lewis.
And Lewis County have one.
And then there's the Vermont AFL-CIO, which is pretty radically different from the rest.
Wait, wasn't the group talking?
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you can elucidate, you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, the Vermont AFL-CIO is the one labor council that is just such an outlier to the rest of the AFL-CIO structure across the country, because they are not only very radically pro-labor, but they definitely do have more of a leftist twinge to them. Like, they get along well with IWW members dual carding in their unions, or like they're very vocal about progressive policies like stopping the war and genocide in Gaza and now in Lebanon. And they're also very pro-environmentalist. It's the one outfit of the AFL-CIO where it's kind of like, we can actually see eye to eye on most things.
I wonder if they're criticized.
Oh, I can probably imagine.
Yeah. What else were you going to say? I was interested in what you were saying.
I forgot, actually.
You were talking about how the Central Labor Council is affiliated with the AFL-CIO versus the IWW's political positions.
And then you amplified that there are differences. There can be isolated. For instance, the ILWU, Lynn's dad's union.
And uncle and grandpa.
And uncle and grandpa. See, Lynn comes from a long line of union people. But they differ from local to local. The local in Tacoma is fairly conservative. The local in Longview is really conservative. But the locals in the Bay Area, they'll close those ports down. They'll close Oakland and San Francisco down so that Mumia Abu-Jamal can get released from prison and things like that. And Leonard Peltier and things. So it varies from local to local. You can't look at your local union and expect them to be progressive, or on the other hand, expect them to be, you know, doctrinaire conservatives. It does vary. That's why the National Council of the Teamsters or the International, whatever they call themselves, wouldn't endorse, fully knowing that a lot of their membership would balk at that. So they left it up to the local and regional councils. So just be a critical thinker when you hear about the positions of labor, quote unquote, and look into it. And if you got some, you know, curiosity about the labor movement in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've got a comment about the IWW and electoral politics.
Mm-hmm.
Consider this. The union was formed in 1905. Primarily the membership, were migratory.
That's right.
Movers.
Itinerant.
They went from work to work, from job to job. You harvested wheat in the Dakotas, and then you moved west to Montana to go mining, moved to Idaho or Washington to cut trees, catch fish, whatever. Or
so they couldn't vote.
They were never there long enough to establish residence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were voteless. Electoral politics was meaningless to them.
Mm.
They had no influence over it. They did not participate because they weren't allowed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About that. And things changed. And with, you know, more sedentary work, employment in factories or other places, if you wish to register to vote, well, you voted
socialist.
There's
still a lot of people that are migratory.
Still.
And cannot vote. Mm-hmm. Or you look at the attempts to purge the voting records.
Oh, boy. Especially in the South. Yeah.
Yeah.
Always. Gerrymandering and all that stuff.
Yeah, and especially at that time, and even still now with migratory workers, you know, there is that precedent of people, A, they can't stick around long enough to establish residence. B, if you have some kind of criminal record, either from a crime of desperation or of personal economic necessity, like, chances are good you also won't be legally able to vote.
In major parts of the United States.
Yes. But from an ideological perspective within the IWW, the big question that is asked of all unions is essentially this, in my mind. Do we want to try and pressure politics internally in order to try and, say, update labor law so it's more pro-union, or fight back against union-busting efforts by pressuring politicians to do something about it? Or do we want to exert our power via the workers themselves in society? And so the IWW takes the stance that we don't endorse political candidates or parties because it's labor that should be calling the shots. Mm-hmm. And if organized labor was organized well enough and strong enough and with the education that they need in order to take the action that they need to take, then the unions themselves could directly pressure politics and the economic forces at large in order to support the union, essentially.
Direct action gets the goods.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
One more thing. I think everybody around this table has had the experience at some point, if they joined, say, the Democratic Party or the Socialist Party or any party, that their energy often gets siphoned off from working on issues to working for candidates.
Mm-hmm. Or platforms.
Yeah. Or platform. And, of course, the Democratic Party, they have a platform, but they don't hold any members to it. So it's useless.
Mm-hmm.
It's words, pretty words. So that's another reason not to endorse candidates. Now, we've had candidates come to the IWW meetings and try to get an endorsement. And we've always been very consistent that we don't endorse. If an individual in the branch decides to endorse and work for a candidate, that's their own business.
Mm-hmm.
They're free to do that.
Right. The union doesn't tell you not to vote. It's just that the union will not put its time, its energy, its money into supporting candidates or parties that might not be able to follow through.
Now, let's talk about initiatives that are coming up. Because
mm-hmm.
there are some initiatives that I'm definitely passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I've been speaking to a lot of the DSA members here in Tacoma about the Workers' Bill of Rights that they're trying to get passed locally here in the Tacoma area. And personally, in speaking with a lot of them and seeing what the platform and how they're trying to accomplish that initiative, I'm very much in favor of it. Things like raising the minimum wage, actually having like hours properly announced 2 weeks ahead of time, you know, trying to end. I think there was also a clause in there about ending piecemeal work. Basically making sure workers have enough pay, enough hours, and enough stability in their lives to have a job that's worth working.
And safety.
Absolutely.
That's also been an issue with the Worker Bill of Rights. If you scale back the workforce and you've got somebody working at 2 o'clock in the morning at a facility that could easily be robbed or broken into, and there is nobody there for them to call, that's a safety issue.
That also reminds me of the Tacoma Art Workers Union. They were also trying to have their security guards included in their unionization campaign because they really liked their security guards and they appreciated the protection that they gave them.
Yeah,
they did, actually.
Yeah, they got them.
Cool.
One thing I will say about the Pierce County Labor Council. Over the last several years, I have heard several members talk about the value of industrial unionism versus trade. And it blew my mind when I heard them saying that. But I think they're starting to see that industrial unionism can be stronger and people more in solidarity with each other.
Absolutely. And I think that the trade unions have, in a very weird roundabout way, kind of taken on some aspects of industrial unionism. Like, for example, the UAW doesn't just organize auto workers. They also do grad students. They also do other forms of manufacturing. The Teamsters covers a large slate of different industries or crafts that they organize in. So to a certain degree, there's still a trade union, craft union model that kind of sets the foundation of those unions. But then there's this slow bleed out that's occurred over the past like century of labor history in this country where the unions are like, oh, okay, we'll take on those workers. Oh, okay, we'll take on that particular industry. And they see the power in that. We've been right all along. The IWW has been right all along. But speaking specifically on initiatives, and then I'll pass it on to someone else, I think that is kind of one of the interesting loopholes in our Constitution as a union is that, yeah, we don't endorse political candidates or parties. We don't make donations. We don't want to waste our time with that. We want to focus on building labor power and organizing campaigns. But the initiatives leaves this nice little loophole for when something like the Workers' Bill of Rights comes up. Because it's like, yeah, this is a blatantly pro-working class initiative on a local level.
So is the Tenants' Bill of Rights, because most workers, regular blue-collar workers, don't own their homes. They're renting.
I mean, in this economy, even the white-collar workers probably can't either.
So those are worker issues.
Mm-hmm. Can somebody at the table give a thumbnail sketch of what an initiative is?
An initiative is allowed in the state of Washington. Not all states have those.
Right.
In the city of Tacoma, if a grassroots organization or any organization wants to change a law or get something codified into law, if they write up what it is they want and they get enough signatures of just regular people, then it can go before the city council. Unfortunately, the city council has some choices about what they want to do. Okay. So in the Tenants' Bill of Rights initiative, enough signatures were gathered, and this was something that was spearheaded by DSA, that's Democratic Socialists of America, Tacoma branch.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders, yeah.
Yeah, but okay, DSA too, in Tacoma. And they got enough signatures, and they had the language looked at by an attorney beforehand to make sure that it was legal and it would fly. When they got enough signatures, they presented it to city council. City council could decide not to bring it forward. What they did instead is a very common trick. They scrambled and came up with their own sound-alike initiative to put before people at the same time as the one that the DSA worked on. And DSA, I love them, sued the city of Tacoma and brought it to a judge. And the judge said, you're right. This thing by the city cannot fly. It is definitely undermining, and the language is designed to confuse the voter.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to put the original initiative before the people, and the people voted for it. It won. Well, now the city had to think about what they wanted to do to screw it. And the reason why the city was so invested in this was the developers.
Mm-hmm.
Of the big apartments were adamant that they did not want these things initiated. Such things as giving adequate notice to renters so that they would have time to move, not evicting Tacoma school children families in the middle of winter, putting a cap on how much they could increase the rent, and they could not increase the rent if they were in violation on the housing code. Tacoma City school teachers could not be evicted in the middle of winter for no cause. We're talking no cause evictions.
Mm-hmm.
And the developers hated it. And the developers pay a lot of money on campaigns, electoral politics,
yeah,
for city council members. So now where we're at is we sued, we being DSA sued, we won, and now the city is countersuing with the help of the developers. They do not want to initiate it. And one way they're sabotaging it is tenants need to know what their rights are, and they're not informing tenants of their rights.
Mm-hmm. Even though the bill that was passed, the initiative that was passed specifically requires it.
Yeah.
Evil.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's
an initiative. Get enough signatures, make sure the language is legal and the issue is legal. Bring it to city council, and then ideally city council puts it on the ballot and it's before the people.
So it's a bottom-up action instead, yes, of a top-down action.
Yes.
Right. And I mean, I think that is something that can be a very effective form of political change, like it was with the Tenants' Bill of Rights, even though the city's trying to screw it over. Or like potentially, hopefully, with the Workers' Bill of Rights, which is going to be the next initiative coming up in the next election.
But then there's always the Tim Iman.
Yeah.
It can work in both ways.
And that's something that's definitely worth highlighting. And so within the context of the IWW and also initiatives, like, yes, initiatives are good. Those local bottom-up voter-initiated changes that people want to make can be good and can be used to the benefit of working class people. On the other hand, specifically speaking as a union, organizing at the point of production, organizing strong, educated, and action-ready unions are some of is, in our view, one of the best, if not the best, way to change the conditions of working people at the shop floor, in their communities. And if it ever gets to what the labor movement could have been in the previous century, a way to externally put pressure on not just capitalists, but also the political system as well, to obey the will of the workers. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason why the IWW has this stance of no parties, no candidates, no electoral donations, anything like that, because our main concern is how can we empower the workers directly?
Well, it's in our Constitution that talks about not endorsing political or anti-political sects. This is sort of a language for our anarchists, fellow workers, that will mollify them somewhat, hopefully, because, you know, if we can't endorse political organizations, then we also can't endorse, like, nationalist organizations, other outfits of that ilk. So we covered our bases. So as an official act, we don't endorse or give a non-endorsement, if you will. But individuals within the union exercise enough autonomy that they can vote. They can even go out and campaign. Just can't do it as a wobbly.
Right.
You know, wear your candidate's T-shirt. Don't wear, you know, one of our buttons, because we don't want to, you know, give them a misapprehension that we're political or anti-political.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, some of the most engaged wobblies that I work with, or at least that I've, especially the ones that I met at convention and stuff, were kind of like, yes, we agree with the IWW's position on, you know, no candidates, no parties, no endorsements, etc. But also they do get involved with organizations like the DSA because they recognize that while as the IWW, our focus and our mission is organizing labor, it's okay as an individual to pursue political paths or help the ones that you see as being most beneficial to working people. And so finally, the last question that I like to raise for the table is, well, then what about changing labor law? If you're not going to endorse a candidate or if you're not going to endorse a party that's quote unquote pro-labor, how do you plan on changing the law? To which my immediate response is, labor laws were literally written in blood by workers who were willing to break the laws of the time. Especially within the context of labor law, things like sit-downs, slow-downs, work to rule, strategies that were incredibly effective from 1900 up until 1945. Well, yeah,
47.
Yeah, 1900 to 1947 when Taft-Hartley was adopted and killed all the fun. Those strategies were especially powerful. And then Taft-Hartley came along and said, no, you can't do that. You have to give proper notice of a strike. You know, you can't slow down or stop work at the point of production. You have to do it in this very meticulous way that hampers unions. And so my response is, well, why don't we have enough labor solidarity and education to be willing to take those risks? And I think that a lot of unions, the trade unions specifically, feel like they're always kind of on the back foot. They have to endorse candidates and parties like the Democrats who will, quote unquote, hopefully, eventually change labor law, like getting rid of Taft-Hartley, even though they haven't brought it up in conversation for 50 years. So that's my personal stance. How does everybody else feel?
I think you hit the nail on the head previously when you mentioned that we don't want to waste energy and resources on political or anti-political campaigns when we could better spend that energy and spend those resources at workplace organizing and other aspects of labor organizing, which also include certain aspects of community organizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is my opinion. Not all wobblies will agree with me. We're a famously contentious, internally contentious outfit. We argue a lot with each other.
Out of love.
Out of just pure love and solidarity. But what I'm getting at is that there's room in our union so that individuals can feel autonomous and also work in concert with other workers. so that that the entire working class can be bonded together in solidarity, and that is political power, not necessarily elections.
Absolutely, especially in the definition of politics you were talking about earlier, the societal, communal sense of politics.
Right.
I think also something that, to kind of go off of something Marilyn said earlier, but I can't remember specifically what it was, you know, the benefit of having a union that doesn't specifically endorse a political candidate or a specific political party is that you get to have more voices at the table at the end of the day. The one cool thing about the IWW, especially within the history of the politically oriented towards like leftist movements that are similar to it, is that we were founded by a pretty interesting hodgepodge of people. You know, you had Eugene V. Debs with what was the Socialist Party of America at the time. You had individual anarchist actors like
Emma Goldman,
Lucy Parsons. You also had other various factions of unions that initially joined in with the IWW because they didn't feel like the craft or trade model was working for them. And so they wanted to get involved with the IWW. And I think that that allows for the kind of conversations to have better forms of internal reform, better conversations about where the direction of the union is going from the perspective of the working people who are in it. And I think it allows for a greater diversity of strategy as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you want to take your local in a particular direction? How do you want to take the union at large in a particular direction when it comes to workplace organizing? I think that that's also a benefit.
Yeah, and you can bring to the table your political traditions, your spiritual traditions, whatever, and people will take what they can use from that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
People, you know, I was in a 12-step program for a while, and they said, take out of it what you need to take out of it. You know, you don't have to follow it chapter and verse. And I think the IWW represents one of the finer traditions of that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. I to kind of tie things off from the perspective of changing labor law, you know, unions used to have the education and the attitude and the strategy of, again, even the trade unions recognize the value of slowing down, sitting down, quote unquote, sabotage at the point of production, which doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't mean replicating the Luddites and throwing a wrench into the gears, literally, but it means that the strike is the most powerful weapon you have, the slowdown, the sit down, working to rule, things like that. And again, because I keep quoting this person on the show, and I swear to our listeners, this is the last time I'm going to do this, Andreas Malm asked the question of the environmentalist movement, and I'm going to ask it now of the labor movement. What's the next step of escalation? If political affiliation isn't working, if the Democrats are too slow, or if the other socialist parties are too slow to actually get a platform big enough to actually have some kind of electoral win and change labor law, then what do we need to do as a union? And for the IWW, it's organize, organize, organize. Organize industrially, organize right. Educate your workers about labor law. Understand how that
impacts. And for God's sake, reach out in solidarity to other progressive groups and other labor organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is more strength in more different organizations working together than even one big union.
I would even go so far as to say that the IWW, something that I am hoping to do, or at least hoping to get the branch on board with, I know I'm talking internal business on the radio, but I feel like it's safe to talk about it. I think that we do need to have a better relationship with the trade unions. We don't have to sign on to their particular model of organizing and political affiliation, but I definitely think that showing up to pickets, showing up to informational pickets, if you're a dual carder in the IWW, which for our listeners, if you're already a member of a union, you can still join the IWW as a labor union. We have a lot of dual carders in our branch. We have UFCW, UAW. I personally am represented at my job through Teamsters 117. Get involved with those councils as well. See what's going on with those workers and see if there's some way you can form a connection and a network of solidarity that way. That's the one thing I took away from the Boeing picket line, was that there was a bunch of other people there who weren't Boeing machinists, but who recognize the importance of what they were doing.
And I'll tell politicians to their face, I'm not going to endorse you, and here's why.
Yes.
When you can show me by your actions, not your words, that you will represent the people, then I'm willing to have your yard sign, but not until then. and the last election you promised X, Y, and Z and you didn't do it, I won't carry your yard sign.
Mm-hmm.
They can scream and they can holler, and they have, but that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH. Unions should not be the ones going to politicians begging for them to do something. It's the politicians who should go to the unions to beg for their endorsement, or in the case of the IWW.
I thought Norm Dix was going to have a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
His face turned red, and he started spluttering. I don't think people tell him that often enough.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, you know, the unions should be the ones, the working people in this country should be the ones calling the shots at the end of the day. And that is something that is very strongly believed by the IWW. They're the ones who should come crawling to us, not the unions should go crawling to the politicians, hoping that they can do what they say they're going to do. And then, like you say, they don't do it.
I'm dying to hear Gordon's book report.
Okay.
Greetings, listeners and fellow workers. My name's fellow worker Gordon, and I'm going to be doing a book review on this episode of the radio show. And the book I'm going to be reviewing is called To Govern the Globe. And the subtitle is World Orders and Catastrophic Change. And it's written by a gentleman named Alfred W. McCoy. And it was originally published in 2021 by Haymarket Books in Chicago. So it's way more recent than some of the books that I've reviewed previously. It's very recent. And it's a history book, and he's a history professor, well-established. He's written several tomes, and it is a extremely well-researched book about how empires arise and world orders. You've heard the expression New World Order, or you've heard the expression about the American century, things like that. That's what he's talking about. And as a historian, he developed some pretty interesting parallels. I'm picturing it like almost a sine wave imposed upon another sine wave. He blends catastrophic changes, you know, bad things that happened in the world, with the rise and fall of empires. So you can see an empire could be very influential, but most of the ones that he outlines only extend for about a century or so, and becoming less with less longevity. So I'm just going to read the table of contents, because it will describe what I'm going to be discussing. And he defines in the first chapter empires and world orders, and then he goes into the Iberian Age, Iberia being Portugal and Spain, empires of commerce and capital, in which he discusses especially the Dutch East India Company and also the British East India Company. And the fourth chapter is Britannia Rules the Waves. The fifth is Pax Americana, which we're at the end of, according to the author. And then the next chapter is Beijing's World System. So he is actually anticipating the American Empire to fail, or at least become way more regionalized. The Western Hemisphere is what he predicts. And the last chapter is called Climate Change in the 21st Century. And this is of interest to us all, especially fellow worker Marilyn, who does frequent commentary on climate change. So the man takes us from basically the Black Death of 1350. And the world order prior to that was, of course, the Roman Empire's world order. The Roman Empire fell and around 450 AD, and then it continued on in Istanbul, which is now known as Istanbul, which was Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire, which lasted until the Ottoman Turks took over in, 600 and something. Anyway, that went along with the rise of Islam. But he couples moral orders and moral systems of thought with political order. For instance, in the Iberian Age chapter, he talks about the Roman Catholic Church a lot, because the act of Portugal and Spain at the Treaty of Tordesillas actually divided the world up into two halves, one for Portugal and one for Spain. They didn't ask anybody else about that, but the Pope just made it so, and it still redounds to this day. That's why Angola and Mozambique, you'll hear people speaking in Portuguese, you know, the descendants.
And Brazil.
Excuse me?
And Brazil.
And Brazil, exactly, because the line went right down where Brazil is. So what he's saying is that formal agreements, and he mentions the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, and then he mentions the end of the Napoleonic Age, which was a disaster, man-made disaster. So you have the Black Death, you have the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and the Treaty, the Council of Vienna, and so they basically just reordered the politics of the world by formal agreement. Pax Americana, Britannia Rules the Waves, of course, happened after 1815, and how Britain, England actually at the beginning, sort of, you know, for better or worse, made a world empire. They owned India, they owned chunks of South America, they owned the United States, as a matter of fact, before it became the United States, and what's known as the Anglophone world, you know, New Zealand, Australia, and even Ireland.
And Canada.
And Canada, indeed. So what the author has done is that he shows that catastrophic change, okay, so we have the Black Death, we have the Napoleonic Wars, that's catastrophic change, and then that invites Britain into this world order scenario.
Now, Gordon, can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
So this is reminding me of Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine,
mm-hmm.
which talks about disaster capitalism.
Exactly. And he I have to tell you that the author is very restrained. You wouldn't take him to be, just by reading him, especially from Haymarket Press, you would expect a more leftist specific orientation. No, nope, this guy's just laying out facts as he sees them and kind of letting us make our conclusion. But you're right. She said disaster capitalism. It's a little bit more accelerated than a world order.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I take your point and I agree with you. It's very similar to that. So he says, you know.
In disaster capitalism, what she talks about, and this she uses the Chicago School of Economics
mm-hmm.
and psychology as examples of what she's talking about in some cases. But she says that different entities, when a disaster happens, consciously take the opportunity to strengthen their position or establish their position. And if a natural disaster doesn't occur, that they can try to create one.
Mm-hmm. And they do frequently. The economic crisis of 2008, for instance, that I think marks the end of the American world order, which, according to the author, happened in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the United States ended up coming out on top in World War II. Europe was completely ruined. The Soviet Union was severely damaged, and of course, it had a tyrant for you know a leader.
So is that your Pax America part?
This is the Pax Americana yeah. part that he talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And he provides numerous examples from history as to how these things happened and how they were forged. So you have this world disaster, which is World War II, and it decimated. You know, people often forget about what the Japanese did. They didn't just, you know, bomb Pearl Harbor. They also invaded China. They owned Korea. Korea was a part of Japan at the time.
Talk to the Koreans about that.
Yeah, I know. They finally got the Olympic record books fixed, you know, because there were a lot of Korean gold medal holders that were running under the Japanese flag, and that's another story. Yeah. I digress.
You do.
But what I'm talking about is that these disasters that occur are capitalized on and create these world orders, which are sort of overarching. The American Empire can fail, but
it is failing.
It is failing. And it will fail, according to the author and according to our, you know, own observations.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm getting at is that the customs go on. And the reason he thinks that that's over is because Beijing has no attachment to international, you know, People's Republic of China. which a lot of people forget is supposed to be a communist government, has no regard for international law, no regard for the International Criminal Court. They dismiss it because it's not valid to them. It's a Western apparatus. So they're forming their own apparatus, which through the Belt and Road Initiative, mm-hmm. that they, I mean, something like 120 countries have signed on to that.
You better define for the listener what the Belt and Road Initiative is.
Okay, the Belt and Road Initiative is a result of a conference that Beijing had, I believe, in 2015, which is an international infrastructure. Oh, I wanted to mention the World Island, which was a concept by a guy named Harold Mackinder. He was a British geopolitician, and he believed that the World Island was the broad landmass of Eurasia, okay, from Japan all the way to Europe, mm-hmm. right? And those who controlled that, right, controlled the world, basically.
Back to Belton.
Belt and Road Initiative is directly tying through infrastructure projects.
That is to transport oil.
Not just oil. It's to it's to have an international transport network through high-speed rail and also through the projection of naval power. So one of the Americans who were very influential in forming the, quote, American century was Admiral Mahan. And he was the guy who promulgated the fact that we needed to have a blue water navy that could control the Pacific Ocean. What this author is saying is that era is ending. And we're seeing it. We got thrown out of a lot of military bases in Asia and or are about to. And the Chinese are going to be preeminent in that geopolitical sphere right there. Because they're building, they have more combat ships now in their Navy than the United States.
They want to project themselves as the competing superpower.
Exactly. With other countries. And they're doing a fine job of it. So McCoy predicts that our, you know, walk in the sun is going to be over by about 2030. Now, we'll still have a lot of power, just like Great Britain has. They still have a lot of capital and power, but they're no longer the moral arbiter of the world.
And we know that this is coinciding with the climate perspective.
Exactly. That's the last chapter in the book, and it's very telling.
Okay. 2030.
Well, yeah. And he mentions several pivotal dates, 2030, 2050, 2070. So he actually, in the last chapter, and in the chapter about Beijing, is projecting into the future based on, you know, historical events from the past. But one thing he did mention is that in the Iberian Age, which was Spain and Portugal, they fully embraced slavery. Mm-hmm. They started the slave trade, mm-hmm. which was continued by the Dutch, which was more of a commercial empire than one based on religion. Okay, so they used the Catholic Church to convert forcibly all the lands that they conquered, and they enslaved those people. Interestingly enough, it was continued by the Empire's Commerce and Capital, the Dutch East India Company, and the British East India Company. But then Britain banished slavery and actually actively boarded slave ships. So they had some kind of claim to moral authority. And similarly, the United States, we've heard the propaganda since we were little kids that we're the land of the free, the home of the brave, the leader of the free world. Well, people are calling us on that. Say, well, if you're the leader of the free world, what about segregation? What about all the black people who are still suffering under the yoke of racial bias and things like that?
What about the indigenous people?
Exactly. What about, you know, the people we stole the land from? So what he's saying is that it's not exactly undercover. There are genuine moral movements, you know, like the abolitionist movement in the United States was very forcible and very morally oriented, no matter how that breaks down when it comes to the nuts and bolts of capitalism, right? But he says that Beijing has no tether and don't have a tradition of respecting human rights, not even, you know, falsely. So he's saying that they're going to be the preeminent power. However, what's going to happen? They're the worst polluter on the planet. They make more coal. They're still building coal-fired power plants. And he's saying that that's going to be their downfall. So he says in the last chapter, unless we get some kind of true global governance, right, And by this is going to upset some anarchists in the audience, because it seems to be, to govern the globe, seems like it's a handbook, right? But what he's saying is that if you try to do that, it's going to break down. We have to have a fundamental moral change in our attitude about the earth and about how we provide for each other and how not to screw up our only spaceship. So it's a book that is, it took me a long time to read because it's got tons of footnotes and tons of endnotes and, you know, maps and 8x10 glossies with circles and arrows and all kinds of very interesting. So if you're a history nerd like me, then you'll love it. But it also has, I'm saying that the last chapter, the one about climate change, is kind of a standalone chapter. You could read that one chapter and get the picture about what he's trying to say about how we are rapidly undermining the very possibility of existence. And therefore, that is the catastrophe for the current world order, right? For the American going over into the Chinese model of hegemony, military and social. So he's saying that that system has to fundamentally change. And if it doesn't, then we've had it. So it's not exactly a cheerful ending to the book, but it is very illustrative of how critical thinking, using the past to address the issues of the present, can actually, you can project into the future what a possible new world within the shell of the old is all about. So I highly recommend it. You can get it from Haymarket Books, and you can get it directly from them instead of going through Amazon. Yes.
Who is the author one more time?
Professor Alfred W. McCoy. I spell M-C-C-O-Y.
And the title again, please.
The title is To Govern the Globe. And all through the book into the last chapter, I thought he was talking about, you know, the various governments and empires of the world. But what he's actually saying is that governing the globe is not really the answer. The answer is a fundamental change in human perception about how to best use our resources before it's too late.
May I suggest, rather than buy the book, go to your library. Ask them is it on the shelves? If not, they will find it for you.
That's
they
a good.
Let you know it's available.
It's a good idea. Or you can borrow it from me.
Okay. There we go.
Briefly, I just want to let people know that here in Tacoma, Client Alliance for the South Sound is doing very good, very effective organizing work to foil the city's plans to pave over the aquifer in the South Sound with 10 football fields long of pavement to put in a mega warehouse. I highly suggest that people contact Client Alliance for the South Sound. I also want to tell the listener that a new group has formed called Climate Catastrophe Ground Zero. That is a coalition group. So far, it is sponsored by, and I'm hoping the IWW will too, but it's sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility, Citizens for a Healthy Bay, Climate Alliance for the South Sound, 350 Tacoma, and other groups. And it is a group that was founded by Benita and Gordon Moore, who are the creators of Native Daily Network and also the creators of the wonderful documentary, which was Ancestral Waters, about the Salish Sea in Tacoma. They are starting, what do I want to call it, a campaign, a two-year campaign, because they have very little confidence that our city government and county government will do what they have pretty words to talk about in terms of dealing with the climate. The city announced climate emergency years ago and has done very little about that. So they're inviting different groups and individuals to come together and work from the bottom up to create the change that they want to see. There are seven different areas that groups can get involved in. So whatever the group's particular strength is, they're welcome to get involved in making change in that direction. This is all very local, of course, but sometimes it's a relief to work on the local level for something that's as large as climate catastrophe. So that's my Enviro report. You can find Climate Catastrophe Ground Zero, which launched today. Today is October the 5th. But if you go on to Native Daily Network, you can also find the information about Climate Catastrophe Ground Zero to get involved, because everybody needs to get involved if we're going to make change on a local, national, and global level. And starting from the ground up is a great way to start. That's my report.
Thank you, fellow worker Marilyn. Does any of the fellow workers here at the table want to talk a little bit about the Anarchist Book Fair that just took place? While we're on local events previous and upcoming, we want to talk about it?
Sure. I go every year, and it's super fun and it's super productive. We get to meet a lot of different people working on things that are sometimes outside of the scope of regular government once again. So our branch, let's see who went. We had Noah, we had me, we had...
I wasn't there.
No, you weren't
Marcus.
There.
You and Marcus.
Oh, I meant Marcus. Marcus and me and Miguel, and we had a fourth person. Oh, Duck.
Mm-hmm.
Duck came too. It was up at the Vera Project in Seattle. And I was very glad to meet several different groups that are working on prison justice issues, which is something that interests me, because our branch has a subcommittee called Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. And we have an event that we'll be doing the week of December 2nd through the 13th. We were asked by jailhouse lawyers speak, which are incarcerated workers, to get the word out about an upcoming prison strike that is nationwide, where the incarcerated workers are not going to buy from the canteen, and they're not going to be working. And they want to get the word out to people all over the United States so that they can come together in support for their, I'm going to call them demands to be able to not be in prison slavery,
mm-hmm.
to have the right to buy things at a fair price, the right to gather, the right basically not to be the slaves of the 21st century. So that will be happening in December, and I used my time at the Anarchist Book Fair to meet some really good people that are working on issues like that too.
Mm-hmm.
And also just meet some off-the-wall people and share a good time.
Lynn, did you have something to say?
Well, my understanding is that immigrants, detained?
Detainees.
Uh-huh. They're contracted. They used to be run by our state, at least. And they're contracted out. And there's no oversight, apparently. And I've heard the food is just horrible. There's been people on hunger strikes. And one has died, at least one. And
the thing is, they're not convicted. They're not convicted of anything.
Right. And they're trapped, and they're never culturally appropriate. And most of them are from, south of the border, other places. And there's no attempt to give them anything cultural, even occasionally, just such unjust conditions.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of a worse idea than a for-profit prison.
Yeah.
Only in America.
For-profit healthcare.
Okay, that's right up there.
Good point.
Fellow worker Lynn, you just recently went to a retired public employees council meeting. What was that like?
We had a convention, and so there were some going over the Constitution and all that, our Constitution. And what it is it's union people that used to be government workers in some capacity that can include nurses. I was a social worker case manager. It includes... all kinds of government employees, a lot of people from DSHS. Anyway, so we're retired, and there's this union. It's affiliated with AFSCME, And they do things like, we do things like lobby the legislature for better conditions, better pensions, keep fighting for our pensions. I'm of a tier called Tier 1 of the Public Employees Retirement System, and we're supposed to be the top tier. We were the first one, and then they added Tiers 2 and 3 for insurance, health insurance, etc. And we're the only one of the three tiers that doesn't have a permanent cost of living. And so that's one of the things that's one of the top priorities. Also, teachers in PERS 1.
By cost of living, you mean cost of living increase?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah. And so it's an active retired group, and I'm happy to be part of it. I've only joined this year. I used to get these notices, and I thought, oh, yeah. But I do believe in unions, and I do believe in the power of unity and fellowship. So anyway.
So there's life after retirement, after all.
There is. Yeah. And so it's real active, lively group. And so if anyone is out there that is part of the public employees that are retired, consider joining it. It's called RPEC, R-P-E-C, and you can find it on Facebook, the usual places.
And other trade unions and industrial unions have active pensioners. I know the ILWU has a very active pensioners section, which means that you're just keeping your hand in. You're keeping your hand in, and you have sage advice from the practices of the past. So I would encourage any former, if you're retired or just you have a different job and were a member of a union, they still have things going on that you can participate in.
Yeah,
good point.
And I got a cool button. It's from 1971 convention, but it says, I'm retired, not expired.
That's good.
I like it.
And then the last event that I wanted to talk about, which both me and Eric were at, which is to talk a little bit about our visit to the picket line. And also, this is an ongoing event. The Boeing strike still isn't off. So if there's any fellow listeners who want to go out and actively help union members fight for a better contract and better pay raises, we'll definitely tell you about that. But fellow worker Eric, if you're interested, do you want to talk a little bit about the picket line and what that was like?
Yeah, it was my first time experiencing something like that. As Noah had spoken of earlier, I wasn't really too sure what to expect. Being a big fan of labor history and just history of the United States, I assumed that it was going to be negatively received, but delightfully, I was wrong. And there was a lot of support, was able to just meet and converse with a lot of just beautiful, compassionate humans that were all there for either direct support or workers themselves that were on strike. And it was just a really beautiful experience to get to be around people that cared about other people's situations, even not being part of that organization. And it was overall just a really beautiful experience. It was just wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, we, like I said earlier in the show, it wasn't just the International Association of Machinists Local 751 that was on the picket line, but, you know, there's IWW, there were the Teamsters, there was AFSCME people, DSA folks, the Tacoma DSA folks were making soup and chili on the picket line at another one of the picketing locations, specifically in Auburn. There is a whole bunch of different folks that just showed up to give good support.
So what location?
Well, I can actually give you and the listeners. The one that Eric and I attended was in Auburn. It's the Boeing facility out in Auburn. I don't have a specific address, but they have three picketing points. The one that we were at was at an intersection along the main drag right in front of the building. So we got a lot of support from vehicular traffic that was passing by. I actually have a list of locations for people who are interested in attending those picket lines.
And times too, please.
So starting off again with the Seattle location, that's at 9125 15th Place South, Seattle, Washington. The Everett location is 2407 106th Street Southwest in Everett. The Renton picket is 233 Burnett Avenue in North Renton. The Auburn picket location, which is where Eric and I were
Bingo.
At.
Bingo, let's hear it.
201 A Street Southwest in Auburn.
Okay.
And then there's a fifth location in Frederickson, which is Puyallup. Mm-hmm. And that's at the Frederickson Industrial Park Road East in Puyallup, Washington. And there's also Moses Lake out east. There's Edwards Air Force Base and Victorville, which
so
is
So I heard something about the Boeing, the union office would do shuttles.
Yes.
Where is the union office located if people need to shuttle?
So their main union hall, which is actually located up in Seattle, that is at 9125 15th Street Place South. And that's in Seattle, Washington, 98108. I know that they have another local union hall in Auburn.
Yeah, you read that address. That was the 201 A Street Southwest.
Okay.
And I just showed up and said, what can I do to help? And they go, who are you here with? And I told them, they go, glad you're here.
Okay, so that's the union office.
Yes, that would be the Auburn Union Hall, yes.
Okay.
But that's the main one is the District 751 office. The machinists have a couple of different districts. I was in different District 160, but there are the many different locals are part of that district.
Mm-hmm. And just to give a clarification, the Auburn Union Hall is at 201 A Street Southwest in Auburn, Washington. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, if anybody out there, any fellow workers, any community members want to go attend any of those pickets, either on a weekday or on a weekend, it's going on 24/7 until the union and management call off the strike for negotiations.
I would advise that if anybody wants to show up, that you go find the picket captain or the person usually with the bullhorn and just announce yourself and say, I'm here in solidarity with the machinists. And they might ask you what outfit you're with. That's fine. You can just be an individual. You can be part of a different organization. But go speak to their picket captains before you participate.
Right? Absolutely. The picket captain that we were talking to, they actually have for the IAM a code of conduct for how they do their picket lines.
Right. We want to make sure that if we lend our support, that we're on message with their message.
Right.
Exactly. I want to thank all of our fellow listeners out there for tuning in. Again, this is WOB Radio, a production of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, a union for all workers of all industries. You can reach out to us at IWW.org, and you can go to the Find a Branch tab and get our contact information, or you can email us directly at tacoma@IWW.org. That's tacoma@IWW.org.
And remember, don't mourn, organize.
Thank you, fellow worker Marilyn. And once again, we would also like to give our thanks to our broadcasters out there. 101.9 KTAH Radio Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA, and all the way up in Bellingham, 94.9 KZAX. We want to thank to all of our listeners out there, and we hope you have a good week, a good month, and we hope to see you out there on the picket line. Solidarity.
Solidarity.